From the Dole Institute of Politics at the University of Kansas, KPR presents The United States and Iran. I'm Kay McIntyre. This month, the United States and Iran took a big step toward normalizing relations. The White House announced the end of 30 years of sanctions and the exchange of prisoners between the two countries. In making the announcement earlier this month, President Obama mentioned the fact that for decades, the governments of the United States and Iran almost never spoke to each other. Enter former Kansas Congressman Jim Slattery. Mr. Slattery has been involved in bridging the divide between the two countries. He spoke at the Dole Institute on March 30, 2015 on prospects for improved U.S.-Iran relations. Audio of this event was provided by Lawrence Bush of the Dole Institute.
This is a historic moment that we're living through right now with the Islamic Republic of Iran. And these negotiations that are going on are vitally important. If we get them right, and if we can come to a win-win verifiable agreement, and that's the key, of course, we can hopefully avoid a tragic and disastrous and costly another war in the world of Islam. And so that's really what's at stake. And I've been telling my friends in the Congress that in the next 5 or 6 months, I believe there's nothing more important in the world than getting this relationship right with Iran, if at all possible. And as we meet here today, we really don't know for sure if that is possible. But we have to explore the options in front of us. So let me just begin by telling you how in the world, you know, I got involved in this. Why would Jim Slattery from Kansas take an interest in Iran, of all places, you know? And I guess I should start by saying that about 10 years ago, after the wars in the Middle East and all the situation in Iraq unfolding, I became completely fascinated with the world of Islam and particularly Iran. I was curious about, you know, how we could figure out how to communicate with Iran and what was a possible bridge to start a conversation. And Cardinal McCarrick, Theodore McCarrick in Washington, and a guy by the name of Doug Coe, who's involved in the National Prayer Breakfast movement in Washington, they invited me into this conversation. And the first thing I knew, I was going off to regular meetings in Europe to meet with high-ranking Iranian officials that have today now emerged in this new Rouhani government in very key positions. And they are key advisors to President Rouhani. They're running very important agencies in this government. One of them is the ambassador to the United Nations, and we also had the opportunity to meet Foreign Minister Zarif and many others. And then in last December, sort of out of the blue, I was invited to come to Iran and speak to a conference called The World Against Violence and Extremism. And, you know, I checked around and some people thought I was crazy to even think about going to Iran, but I have been so fascinated by the country and I had an official invitation from the government, so I figured I would be safe in going there. And it turned out that everything went off very, very well. But at the conference entitled World Against Violence and Extremism, President Rouhani, Foreign Minister Zarif, and the Chief of Staff to the President, a guy by the name of Mohammad Nahavandian, they all made statements that I wish the Western media would have communicated and picked up. And they were all condemning violence in the name of Islam in very, very direct and very specific ways. Now, I should mention also that when we started what we called an Abrahamic dialogue, and we called it Abrahamic because we involved all of the Abrahamic faiths. So Jews, Christians, and Muslims were participating in this conversation. And the idea originally was to engage the Islamic Republic of Iran to talk about faith. Now that sounds pretty simple and for some perhaps naive. But the idea was, it is called the Islamic Republic of Iran. And the people in Iran are very serious about their faith. It's a very big part of their lives. And the thought was, why don't we start talking to them about issues that are relevant to their faith, and also maybe issues that the Abrahamic faiths share in common. And maybe that's a place to start a conversation. And sure enough, we would come to these gatherings, and we would have very interesting sort of esoteric topics to talk about. One topic was, for example, on business ethics in the Abrahamic faith traditions. And we talked about the just war theory in the view of Muslims, Christians, and Jews. We even had one conference because the whole issue about the theology of end times. It's called eschatology theology. I never heard of the term before, okay? But we learned about the teachings in the faith books relevant to the end times. So in the book of Revelations and in the prophets of Jeremiah and all the old ancient Old Testament prophets, what they had to say about the end times. Because there are millions of people around the world today that happen to believe we are in the end times. But it was another topic that we focused on in one of these meetings. But as we would visit about all these faith issues and trying to find some common ground, we would also have the opportunity to start building some friendships. Much to my amazement, as we were visiting with some of our government officials, we were advised that this conversation was the only conversation going on with Iranians. Absolutely stunned me. The Iranians told me during the Bush 2 administration that they saw this conversation that we were involved in as the most important conversation going on with the United States. And I came back and visited with some of the people in our administration at the highest levels, and I shared this with them, and they told me, well, we can understand why they think that, because it's the only conversation going on with them. You know, now, I happen to believe, one of the things I'll share with you very quickly, is that we do not do ourselves any favor by isolating ourselves from people that we have difficulties with. You make peace with your enemies. You don't necessarily make peace with your friends. You make peace with your enemies. And the only way you make peace with your enemies is to talk to them. And you know, one of the things I learned while a student at Washburn Law School, and I'm a farm boy from Atchison County, but one of the things I learned in Washburn Law School is that the first thing you do in a dispute, whether it's a lawsuit or in a negotiation, is you attempt to learn everything you can about the guy across the table from you. You want to learn what their deepest fears are, what their deepest needs are, what their deepest aspirations are, what their dreams are. You want to get to know them. And then when you get to know them, you have a little better chance of trying to figure out how you can find the common ground. So, you know, as I was visiting with Senator Dole today, I shared with him, I said, you know, Senator, it's too bad we don't have someone like you that had your skills at finding the common ground and sort of finding where the deal could be made and where the win-win was involved in these discussions in Switzerland. We need you over there. You got a sort of a kick out of that. But you know, this art of finding the common ground, the win-win, is a lost art in Washington these days. And we have to figure out how to teach that skill perhaps a little better. But so we've been involved in these discussions for the better part of 10 years. And in the process, we've had the opportunity to meet now what are many of the high-ranking officials that are running the Rouhani government in Iran. And I will share with you also that the election of President Rouhani was a major new event in Iran. And I've suggested to some people that Rouhani may be, we don't know for sure, but he may be a Gorbachev-type figure, a transformational leader. And we don't know, but he may be. And we should position ourselves so that if he is, we can respond to that appropriately. So I will share with you that when I went to get my visa in Washington to go to Iran in December, I was interviewed by the three people who run the interest section, as it is called, at the Pakistan embassy. So I walk in and sit down, they serve me tea and cookies and stuff. And believe it or not, two of the three graduated and have degrees from Kansas State University. Okay? And one of them said, "Congressman, I think I remember you as my congressman when I was living in Manhattan." Okay? Now you think this is amazing. The other guy, the third one, has a degree from Oklahoma State University. Okay? So I show up in Tehran, and the first evening, we have this sort of formal dinner with high-ranking government officials there. Guess who is sitting right next to me in my table? A guy by the name of Majid Ravanche. Guess where Majid earned his degree? The University of Kansas, okay? So we start talking Jayhawk basketball, you know, in Tehran, you know? But anyway, the point of the matter is that these kind of relationships and meeting people and learning about where they are, I think are vitally important. And it's been amazing to meet some of these people and just sort of hear their side of the story, if you will. Let me make a few sort of what I call random observations to sort of put some of this in context. First of all, Iran is a country of 80 million people. 80 million. It's a country, population-wise, that's bigger than France. The literacy rate in Iran is about 90% for everybody under 50. Okay, we're dealing with Persians, not Arabs. Every time I sit down and talk to Iranians, as we call them, Persians as they prefer to be called, okay, they remind me that they are Persian Shia surrounded by Sunni Arabs. They say, "Do you understand that? Do you Americans understand this?" That is very important. The other fascinating thing, and I could talk about a lot of fascinating points, but something very unique to Iran in the world of Islam is that 60% of all of the university students are female. 65% of the graduate students are female. And in every country throughout history, when you educate women, profound things happen in that culture, okay? And that is something that as we look at Iran and contemplate a future relationship with Iran, we have to take into consideration. And when I have visited with some of these people who I've befriended in Iran, I say to them late at night after a day of conversation about war and peace or whatever, I say, as you look out into the future in your country, you know, what are the things you're really most concerned about? And I've had several of them tell me, in all candor, they would say, "Jim, we're really worried about what we're going to do with all these educated women." So I just point that out, that is something very unique in Iran, and I think it's a source of hope and optimism as we deal with this country going forward. The other thing that I think that all Americans should be mindful of is that the Iranians have a legitimate list of grievances with our country. So back to the point that I made about how do you prepare for a lawsuit, how do you prepare for any negotiation, learn about the other side. Learn about what's driving them, where their head is. And it's important for us to realize that in 1953, the United States, working closely with Great Britain, so it was Eisenhower and Churchill, basically, that led the effort to overthrow the freely elected government of Iran, led by then by a man by the name of Mossadegh. And just to learn more about this, over the weekend, much to Linda's chagrin, I told her that I needed to go to the Eisenhower Museum in Abilene to look at, of all things, the National Security Council minutes of 1953, and I wanted to look at Eisenhower's diary. Okay? So as I was looking at his diary, I would draw your attention to his entry of October the 8th, 1953, page 10. Okay? And it was interesting because in that, and this is all public information, it's out there if you want to go research it, but basically Eisenhower was acknowledging that we had participated in the overthrow of the Mossadegh government and how this was a covert operation and how it would be very embarrassing if this was ever revealed. And if it was, we would probably never be able to do something like this again, okay? The reason I mention this is because it is that experience in 1953 that started this relationship in modern times with Iran. And it started with the United States working in close cooperation with the British. And there was an oil dimension of this dispute, by the way, that I could go into, but I won't, that got us involved in this. And there was great fear about the Soviet expansion into Iran and gaining access to the oil fields. And so the concern was that Mossadegh, who was nationalizing the British petroleum oil interest, because the British were actually cheating them terribly, and it should have been renegotiated. But the long story short is that the concern was that the Russians were going to move into Iran and put at jeopardy these oil fields. So we participated in the overthrow of Mossadegh. When you talk to Iranians today, they will talk about that event as if it happened last Thursday. And it is a deep affront to them, as you might imagine. You know, us getting involved in the overthrow of their freely elected government. Now fast forward 16 years, 1979. And during that period of time, we reinstated the Shah, and we trained the Shah's secret police, called SAVAK. So the CIA trained SAVAK, and ironically, the Israeli intelligence operation called Mossad also helped train SAVAK. And SAVAK was a bad operation. They did terrible things to support the Shah. And the people now running Iran, many of them that were out in the streets demanding the Shah leave the country or demanding his head, basically, more specifically, many of them had family members who were the victims of SAVAK. SAVAK tortured a lot of people. And the Iranians saw this as the United States' involvement in their country, and they deeply resented it. And many of them hated us and blamed us because of injuries visited upon their family members. So I mentioned this sort of starting point in a relationship so we understand the Iranian perspective of this relationship with the United States and how it started. And then, you know, Americans, you know, we just started focusing on Iran in 1979 when they seized our embassy and took all of our hostages and humiliated us for 444 days. And they didn't release them until Ronald Reagan was sworn in as president at high noon on the day that power was handed over, our hostages were released. And we started to see in our first introduction to Iran was these incredible images of these people in the street that appeared to be angry and out of control and who knew what they were. And so our images of Iran were shaped then, and we've been struggling since. And the long story short is, Iranians did some terrible things to their own people following their revolution, and there are a lot of human rights abuses even to this day going on in Iran, and that shouldn't be swept under the carpet. The Iranians mistrust us as we mistrust them. That's the bottom line. And I will share with you also that they blame the United States for their horrible losses in the Iran-Iraq war that we know very little, if anything, about. That was about a 7-year war with Iraq. And Saddam Hussein, with the support of the United States, invaded Iran. Now, we didn't necessarily really encourage it, but we sort of supported it. And Saddam Hussein used gas against Iranians, and about 175,000 Iranians died in that war. 175,000 people died. And that was over this period of time. And the range and estimates of losses go up to 500,000, but the 175,000 is the low number. Iranians don't totally blame the United States, but they believe that the United States was complicit, didn't do what it could have done to stop Saddam's invasion of Iran. So they hold that against us. The other thing they hold against us is the shooting down of the civilian airliner, you know, from the USS Vincennes, if you might remember. There were about 300 people that died in an airplane that was shot out of the sky by one of our naval vessels in the Persian Gulf. And one of the little things that the Iranians watch us very closely. They monitor us hourly, and they monitor what our politicians are saying hourly. And they, I mean, when I have any conversations with them, I better be up on things, because they'll be telling me things that I haven't read in my own, in our own media. But one of the things that they pointed out to me that I did not know was that even after we apologized for the USS Vincennes incident, we decorated the commanders of the ship. We gave them medals for their performance. So the Iranians look at this and say, you know, what are you really doing here? What messages are you sending to us? So anyway, I share that in terms of just sort of, you know, random thoughts, and just so we have some sense of how the Iranians see us. And I think that's important for us. I'm not saying I agree with their perceptions. I'm just sharing with you their perceptions, sort of where they're coming to the table, I guess you might say. Now, let's talk about the current situation. We've touched on some of it already, but I will tell you that nobody knows for sure where these negotiations are going, obviously, but based on the context I've had over there and the conversations I've had, I've concluded that the Rouhani government wants a deal with the United States. And I believe that the Rouhani government represents that element within Iran that recognizes that they need to change policies with the United States and with the West. There are those within Iran who disagree with that sharply. So the Revolutionary Guard, and those that I'm told are benefiting from the sanctions, also oppose an agreement with the United States. So we have the religious hardliners in Iran who oppose an agreement with the United States because they're fearful that growing contact with the West, especially the United States, will compromise the Islamic Revolution. So they're coming at it from a religious perspective. There's another group that are coming at it from a strict monetary business perspective, and that is, we like these sanctions because we're making a lot of money behind this sanction wall. So don't mess up the status quo. Okay? So that element is playing out also. And then you have the Rouhani government and the people around President Rouhani, who I believe are anxious to get an agreement with the United States. I've even suggested that I believe some of them have bet their political careers on getting an agreement with the United States. And so I think there's great desire on the part of the Iranian government to get an agreement. I think that President Obama also would like to get an agreement, if at all possible. So, and I also believe that when the dust settles, the Iranians are prepared to make some major concessions on things like, for example, agreeing to not enriching uranium above 5%. And to get to weapons grade, you have to be north of 90%. And that's easily monitored, whether you're enriching at 5% or 90 or 95%. So I'm convinced that they will agree to limit their enrichment activity to 5%. I'm also convinced that they will agree to limit the quantity of enriched uranium that they possess. And I think they will also agree to reduce significantly the number of centrifuges that are in operation. It's interesting, over the last 10 years, when we've had these tough sanctions in place, trying to, you know, beat them into submission, so to speak, they have moved the number of centrifuges operating and spinning from about 150 to today, somewhere in the neighborhood of 9,000. Now they have 20,000 that are actually available, but only about 9,000 of them have been operational. And centrifuges are like cars in that a 1962 Chevrolet performs differently than a 2015 Chevrolet. So not every centrifuge is equal. So we're going to have a big debate over the number of centrifuges. But I believe that the Iranians ultimately can be persuaded to dramatically reduce the number of centrifuges, and probably, again, we don't know until we find out, agree to link the quantity of enriched uranium to the volume of enriched uranium they need for peaceful purposes. So they'll back into this. They'll measure sort of how much enriched uranium is needed for peaceful purposes, and they'll back into the number of centrifuges and the quantity of enriched uranium needed to produce that. I don't believe that the Iranians will ever agree to eliminate their enrichment capability. They believe that they have that right under the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. And they're not willing to compromise that as a matter of sort of national dignity, honor, respect, call it what you like. They quickly point out that Israel has never signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And of course, Israel has nuclear weapons. They probably have somewhere between 50 and 100 nuclear weapons by best guesstimates. And their facilities are not subject to inspection by the International Atomic Energy Agency. And this is a source of great irritation to the Iranians, as you might imagine. So I'm just pointing out to you the Iranian perspective on all of this. So I think that as we move into the final stages, I'm convinced it's going to get very difficult because we have multiple nations involved in these negotiations. So the Russians, for example, are at the table negotiating with us. The French, the Germans, the Russians, and the Chinese, okay? Now let's pick those countries apart one by one, okay? So you're Russia, and you're committed right now to expanding your influence and aggressive activity in the continent of Europe. I'm very worried about Mr. Putin and where he's going. So you're Mr. Putin, and do you think that Mr. Putin is going to really applaud an agreement between Iran and the United States? He wants us distracted in the Middle East. He wants to see the United States get sucked into as many wars in the world of Islam as possible. Okay? And the other side of this with Russia is that Russia does not want Iran's energy in the global marketplace. And Iran is an energy superpower. So Russia's whole economy is tied to the price of global oil. So does he want Iran to have an agreement with the West that will invite huge investment into their oil sector so that would increase dramatically the exports of oil from Iran and drive down the price of global oil prices? I don't think Mr. Putin thinks that way. He does not want that Iranian oil in the global marketplace. And he does not want Iranian natural gas in the marketplace. He has basically a monopoly today on the supply of natural gas to Western Europe. Germany, Italy get 50, 60% of their natural gas from Russia. And the Iranians are capable of being a competitive option for the Europeans when it comes to natural gas. So I am telling my friends that are involved in these negotiations that beware of the Russians, okay? I'm not convinced they're on board with an agreement. They would like to see this thing fester and fester as Putin plays his games out in Europe. The French, very interesting. Several weeks ago, they announced that they're going to build a huge Peugeot plant in Iran. Now, French and other global business interests have access to the Iranian marketplace today that we do not have. And they're seizing business opportunities, including the French, while we're talking at the table. And I question whether some of them even want a deal because they have free access to these markets without U.S. competition. So I'm just raising these as questions because then I look at the Chinese and I say, okay, from China's perspective, you know, how do they view all of this? When the United States is dealing with Iran the way we have been dealing with them over the last 35 years, the effect of all this is sort of to push Iran with their enormous energy supplies and their market into the hands of the Chinese. And the Chinese like this, but the Iranians do not like it because it limits their options and they'd rather deal with the West. The Persians identify with Europeans and Americans much more easily than they identify with the Chinese. They want a future with the West and not with the Chinese, but our activity is sort of pushing them in the direction of the Chinese. The Chinese look at the United States, and I was in China last summer, the Chinese look at the United States and they hope we get sucked into endless war in the world of Islam. As they build up their economy and build up their military, they hope we're spending trillions of dollars in Afghanistan, Iraq, all over the Middle East, and God forbid, in Iran. So that's sort of the big picture of what's going on around this negotiating table in Switzerland. Let me also just point out that, of course, Israel is deeply concerned about all of this. as we can all understand. And with Mr. Netanyahu, he makes it very clear that he's opposed to an agreement and spoke to the Congress, made it very clear, and has been really working hard to prevent an agreement that he doesn't like. And they talk about, for example, and let me just observe that I can totally understand Netanyahu's perspective, because when it comes to the issue of defending Israel, and that's Bibi Netanyahu's number one responsibility, there is no margin for error. One bomb on Israel, and Israel is destroyed. And so I can totally understand his deep commitment, obviously, to the defense of his country. The question is whether we can best prevent Iran from developing a nuclear weapon by continuing these negotiations and finding out where they take us, or, on the other hand, we can blow up these negotiations, stop them, and then what? And that's the question Mr. Netanyahu has not answered to my satisfaction. And he says, well, we'll just impose tougher sanctions. To which I respond, we've had sanctions for the last 10 years. And during that period of time, Iran has taken the number of centrifuges from 150 to 200 to 10,000, roughly. Did it work? I don't think so. They also learned to enrich uranium from 5% to 20% during the same period of time. And I would bet that they have the ability to go a lot higher than 20% if they really wanted to. So I do not think that the Netanyahu approach to these talks makes a lot of sense. And you know, he's basically saying that we're not going to accept any deal that permits Iran to have any nuclear enrichment capability. Well, that isn't going to happen, in my opinion. And in the opinion of the P5 plus one, all the countries negotiating, I think they share that view as well. So I think that we need to be aware also of one other fact that's very unique to this time. And that is that a guy by the name of Sheldon Adelson, and I hate to pick out one billionaire, okay? There are other billionaires now. I mean, these people have, you know, Adelson's worth is somewhere in the neighborhood of $30 billion. And there are other billionaires out there that are spending a lot of money in our political process. Adelson is unique because he has spent over the last few election cycles somewhere in the neighborhood of $200 million. And when asked why he was doing this, he said, because of Israel. Okay? Well within his rights. But what is very troubling to me is that several weeks ago, he was speaking at Yeshiva University in New York. And when asked what his approach to Iran was, he said, well, the first thing I would do, and this is a bit of a paraphrase, I would drop a nuclear weapon in the deserts of Iran, and I would tell the Iranians, give up all of your enrichment capability, or we're going to drop another one on Tehran. Okay? Now, the Iranians are listening to all of this. And they know, they can read our election returns and they can read our filings for contributions and everything. And they're wondering what influence that $200 million is having in our government. And they're wondering whether Sheldon Adelson commenting in New York is expressing some opinion that is shared by a number of people in our country. So, I mean, I just share that with you. It's an interesting dimension of what's going on in this discussion right now and in these negotiations. But the main thing we have to keep in mind is that the Iranians listen carefully to what's said by our political leaders in the United States. You know, I have talked longer than I planned to, sort of like one of those, you know, long-winded professors or something, huh? But I would just conclude by observing that this is a historic moment. I don't know where these negotiations will take us in the next few days or in the next few months. But what I believe very strongly is that we have a moral obligation in this country to always exhaust diplomatic options before we resort to any kind of military conflict. And one of the things that I felt very strongly about growing up during the Vietnam era and learning about the choices that my government officials made during those times. I swore that when I was a member of Congress, and I'm no longer a member of Congress, but I swore that when I was a member of Congress, when it came to making decisions about war and peace, I would do everything humanly possible to learn as much about the facts as I could to make a sound judgment about sending our young men and women into harm's way. And we are at perilously close to backing into another conflict in the world of Islam that will cost us trillions of dollars, that is desperately needed right here in the United States. And if there's any way that we can avoid spending trillions of dollars and killing thousands of people and seeing thousands of our young men and women killed and wounded for life, then we have to do everything we can as citizens to learn the facts and to express our opinions to our elected officials. So I'm going to do everything I can do as a lone taxpaying Kansan to encourage this discussion and to do what we can to encourage our elected officials to exhaust our diplomatic remedies. Let's find out what's possible before we blow up discussions and say, you know, it's time to start dropping the bombs. So anyway, thank you for coming out, and I'll be happy to answer your questions.
You're listening to former Kansas Congressman Jim Slattery speaking at the Dole Institute of Politics. Slattery now takes questions from the audience.
Yes, questions.
Thank you for coming today, Congressman. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the letter that the U.S. senators sent to Iran recently and what effect that has had on the negotiations that you've been dealing with.
Very good question. And I will tell you that when I was in Iran visiting with the Iranian officials, and these were officials, high-ranking officials in the Rouhani government. They were members of the religious clerics, and they were close to the supreme leader. They were members of the Majlis, which is their country's Congress or parliament. Everywhere I went and every conversation I had, nearly the first question I was asked was, can President Obama implement an agreement? They did not want to put their best offer on the table and have President Obama accept it, only to have it rejected by the United States Congress in some way. And they were very curious about what effect the elections were going to have on the Congress's ability to block the president's implementation of the agreement. And they were pointing out to me that if that would happen, that would be a disaster for the moderate elements in Iran that are leading this effort right now. And when Senator Cotton and others suggest there are no moderates in Iran, that is dead wrong. Dead wrong, okay? And this letter, I can best share my observations about this letter by just asking a question. Imagine October 1962, and some of us in this room are old enough to remember October of 1962, the Cuban Missile Crisis. Now imagine how we would have reacted if a few senators had written a letter to Khrushchev suggesting that President Kennedy didn't have the authority to negotiate. Now think about this. I mean, it's pretty amazing to me, to tell you the truth. Absolutely amazing. Yes.
I was thinking about all those things you was going through up there, but I never did hear any money mentioned. Do we give them money or do we not give them money?
You know, excellent question. And you heard me say that Iran is an energy superpower. And you know, in these discussions and in this whole process, there has not been any talk about U.S. money being appropriated to Iran. Iran is a wealthy country. And if they can get this right with the West, they will attract huge amounts of investment to modernize their energy sector, and the oil will flow out of Iran. The natural gas, if this is done right, could flow to Europe and give Putin a lot of competition that he does not want for natural gas. And the other thing, again, I'm an eternal optimist because I guess it's part of my DNA. I'm a Kansas Democrat, you know, so you have to be, you have to be sort of irrationally optimistic, you know. But you know, yes, but I would just say that if we can get this right with Iran, and again, I don't know, but if we can, yeah, it opens up all kinds of opportunities for discussion about ISIS. And, you know, this is very interesting. ISIS is a radical element of Sunni Islam. And one of the things that I should have pointed out was, you know, there are 1.3 billion Muslims in the world today, and probably about 300 million of them are Shia, like the ones in Iran. So about a billion are Sunni. And one of the things I use every opportunity to do is remind Americans that all of the people that were on those planes on 9/11, every one of them was a Sunni. There were no Shia on those planes. There were no Iranians on those planes. They were all Sunni, most of them Wahhabi. 15 of the 19 that attacked us on 9/11 were from Saudi Arabia. Okay. Two from Egypt, two from the United Arab Emirates. Okay. Now, think about this. Shia, I am unaware of any terrorist attack in the United States visited upon us by any Shia. Every terrorist attack in the United States that I'm aware of was committed by Sunni. So when we look at the Middle East and we sift through all this stuff, we have to understand this Sunni-Shia divide. And we have to understand that Iran is going to protect the Shias that are being repressed in the region, in the Middle East. They're sort of like family to the Iranian Shia, and they will protect them. And I mean, that's just part of the region. Israel and others, including the United States, have been very outspoken about their concern about Iran expanding its influence in the Middle East. You know what my response is? Yes, that's going to happen. Now, why is it going to happen? It's going to happen because they have a population of 80 million. They're 90% literate. They are an energy superpower. They are 10 times the size of Israel, population-wise. They have the largest economy in the region. They're 3 times the size of Iraq. And they're about 3 times the size of Saudi Arabia. Another little factoid about Saudi Arabia is nearly 70 to 80% of the oil in Saudi Arabia is under Shia land, even though the Shia only represent about 15% of the population in Saudi Arabia. So the Saudi royal family, which is opposing this agreement or any kind of agreement between the United States and Iran, they're doing so for a whole bunch of reasons. But one of those reasons is that they do not want Iranian competition in the global energy markets either. And they have this ancient animosity and hostility going on between Shia and Sunni that go back to shortly after the time of Muhammad. You know, we're going back to the 700s, for goodness sakes. You know, so these ancient rivalries are very intense, and they're being played out in some of these areas even today. I'm sorry, that was another speech, and I promised Maynard to be very short. Maynard?
Jim, thank you for being here. Comment on two things, if you would, please. Number one, how much influence did the invasion of Iraq in 2003 have on the destabilization of the entire Middle East that we see today? And then secondly, to follow on the question about the 47 senators signing that letter, what is it going to take for the United States, in your judgment, to start pulling together instead of having the same divisions and private interests, as you mentioned about China and Russia and so on, in these negotiations?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, when I was in the Congress, I voted to authorize President Bush 1 to liberate Kuwait. And before I did so, I went to the Middle East and I went out to see the 1st Infantry Division that was deployed in the desert and came back and gave one of the closing speeches in the Congress authorizing President Bush 1 to liberate Kuwait. So I supported that war. I strongly opposed the war in 2003 in Iraq, even though I supported what we were trying to do in Afghanistan to get after the Taliban. By the way, the Iranians helped us destroy the Taliban in Afghanistan. Okay, but I really strongly opposed the war in Iraq, and I did so because any country boy from Kansas that understood a little bit about that region would have understood very quickly that if you take out Saddam Hussein, who was Iran's biggest enemy and was sort of the buffer between Iran and Israel, what would be the result? You would empower Iran, right? You destroy Iran's biggest enemy in the region, you're going to empower Iran, and that's exactly what we did. And in the process, instead of communicating to Iran at the time that we're not coming after you in Iran, we're not coming after the Iranians, we never really did that. So we created this perception that Iran was the next country on the list. So while we had our army there, you know, there was some that were advocating at the time that we should also just move into Iran, which that council was rejected, thank goodness, by President Bush too. But the Iranians saw this army in Iraq and they were worried that it was coming after them as well. And they responded as they did. I mean, they started helping the Shia militias in Iraq fight us in Iraq. And we were off to the races. But that's a part of this, again, that we have to be mindful of, is that by taking out Saddam, we empowered Iran dramatically. I've often observed that we have done more to help Iran in the last 10 years than maybe any country in the history of the world, and got so little for it. You know? We took out their worst enemy and got nothing for it. You know, because we weren't talking to them, we weren't engaging them, we were sort of ignoring them. You know, it'd be a little bit like trying to deal with North America while ignoring the United States of America. You know, I mean, whether we like it or not, Iran is a country of 80 million people, energy superpower, highly literate, three times the size of Iraq, three times the size of Saudi Arabia, 10 times the size of Israel, and we suck our thumbs here saying their influence is increasing in the region. I got news for you. By virtue of population, resources, talent of the people, geography, history, and religion, the influence of Iran in the Middle East is going to continue to increase regardless of what we do. Yes.
Jim, I want to thank you. This has been very educational. I want to, pun intended, drill down a little bit on the oil subject you avoided earlier.
Yeah.
I'm curious to know what type of effect, given the awful influence that the oil and gas industry have over our politics here, mm-hmm. what type of influence does the global oil and gas industry have right now with this negotiation going on with Iran at this time?
Yeah. Good question, Joe. And the short answer is I don't know, but I don't believe they have much influence in what's going on at the negotiating table right now in Switzerland. And I don't believe that the U.S. oil and gas industry is going to play a negative role in the Congress and the way the Congress responds to all of this. So I don't see them being a huge player right now. Now, as I've already pointed out, I believe Russia has deep concerns about what an Iranian rapprochement with the United States and Europe would mean with respect to the energy business. I'm expecting the Russians to do whatever they can to blow this deal up somehow. I'm expecting that. Yeah.
Yes. Thanks for coming. Would you speak a little bit about the role of the Supreme Ayatollah and what influence he's exerting on these negotiations?
Yeah. Every indication that I have gotten in the conversations of all these people that I've talked to is consistent with what I think our government believes, and that is that the Supreme Leader has authorized Minister Zarif to conduct these negotiations. I believe the Supreme Leader is very skeptical about dealing with the United States. The Supreme Leader does not trust the United States and believes the United States is still committed to what they call regime change, and that was a term often used during the Bush years, and that to them means you're trying to overthrow our government again. And so the Supreme Leader is very, he doesn't trust the United States. And he's given Zarif authority to negotiate, and he's going to look at the deal. And everything I'm told is if Zarif agrees, the Supreme Leader will agree. And I think the Supreme Leader wants a deal with the United States if it is reasonable and if it is respectful of their rights. And their right, number one, in their perspective, is that they have the right under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty to have enrichment capabilities for peaceful purposes. And that's a right that I don't believe the Supreme Leader will give up. But I think that he's in the game. I think he's supportive of the negotiations. I think he wants to see where they're going to go. And that's sort of where I am. Let me just observe, one of the things that have been very troubling, back to the gentleman's question about the 47 senators, is I am very troubled by why the members of Congress, and I don't fully understand why, they are so opposed to an agreement they haven't even seen. They haven't seen the details of this. And the devil will be in the details of this agreement. There are key things that have to be worked out on the technical dimension of all of these issues around enrichment and centrifuges and levels of enrichment and quantities of enriched uranium permitted and the kind of inspections that are committed and what kind of areas are you going to be inspecting. You know, I am told that we're negotiating to have access to inspect the uranium flow from the mines to the centrifuges. Well, there are tremendously complicated issues here that members of Congress have not seen. Why would 47 members of the Senate try to blow up negotiations on a deal they haven't even seen? Honest to goodness, it's just amazing to me. And, well, the press should, and I'd like to ask them myself. But, I mean, it seems to me the appropriate role of Congress in this would be to let the president and let the administration that's responsible for the conduct of foreign policy to negotiate the agreement. And when the agreement is brought back to the Congress will have a role in the implementation of the agreement. After all, the Congress is going to have to vote at some point in the future about lifting the congressionally imposed sanctions. Now, that's when the Congress can weigh in. And I would also point out, 1962, President Kennedy didn't go to the Congress after negotiating the agreement with Khrushchev to see if the Congress was going to go along with the deal. He didn't do that. So, you know, we ought to tell our entire congressional delegation, just hold your horses. And let's wait and see the details of the agreement.
My question goes back to what you originally started with, but the way you got involved in the Iran and the prophetic literature of each of our religions.
Yeah.
I woke up today preparing to come down here and thought of a passage in, I thought it was in Isaiah, it actually is in Jeremiah, and Micah the same, talks about beating plowshares into... Swords into plowshares and fishhooks.
Yeah.
And this is part of the prophetic literature of our standing.
Yeah.
And it seems to me it's important if we're going to do what God has intended us to do, to try to do things in a more civil and thoughtful way.
Yeah.
And I assume maybe that's probably something else in the other religions as well. And it seems like we also tend to be selective in our reading of the Bible to come to the point that we want to make.
Yeah, that's a temptation, I suppose, for all of us, isn't it? We tend to read those passages that we like and embrace them and ignore those passages we don't particularly like, I suppose. You know, thank you for bringing me back to the sort of point of departure, and that is that this dialogue has been a faith-based dialogue. So all of our discussions were deeply respectful of each other's religious beliefs. And, you know, like I have pointed out, in every delegation from the United States, there were prominent Christians, Muslims, and Jews that represented the United States. And then the Iranians sent leaders from their religious community, business community, academic community, government community. So they had their high-ranking officials. And we all learned a lot about the common ground in the Abrahamic faiths. And I concluded, after all these discussions, that there's no reason why I could not live between a Jew and a Muslim that was a faithful Jew and a faithful Muslim, and I, as a Christian in the middle, there's no reason in the world why we couldn't live together as peaceful neighbors. And if we're really adhering to the basic teachings of our faith in the middle, in the sort of the moderate section, I guess you might say, let me share with you just one little observation that I made. Again, these were dealing with Shia Muslims, who, by the way, have a deep reverence for Jesus. And the clerics, whenever they would say his name, they would bow their head and they would say, "Blessed be his name." And so as we had these conversations, we learned that, I learned, others perhaps knew before these conversations, but I learned that Muslims are required to accept all of the teachings of the prophets, including Jesus. Okay? And as Christians, supposed to be following Jesus too. So I would jokingly suggest to my Iranian friends that you, as a Muslim, are directed, commanded, taught to follow the teachings of all the prophets, including Jesus. And I'm supposed to be following him too. You know, do you think there's a space here for conversation? So I've observed that if we can figure out how to get this together, that our Jewish neighbors and friends will be the beneficiary of a better agreement and a better understanding. So I'm all in favor of interfaith dialogue and as a way to respond to these bastardized versions of Islam that are finding great attraction, and a lot of young people are embracing it. Let me share with you just one other quick thing. I'm involved in another group called, it's ICRD, it's the International Council on Religion and Diplomacy. And our focus has been on trying to reform the madrasa schools, which are schools, Islamic schools, in the world of Islam from the Balkans to Indonesia. And one of the things I learned in this process is that the Saudis, over the last 15 years, have spent billions of dollars funding madrasa schools in the world of Islam. And what do these madrasa schools do? Many of them, in the textbooks, now the Saudis are changing this recently, and they're making some progress. But over the last 10 years, they've spent billions of dollars funding these madrasa schools, and the textbooks in these madrasa schools teach young kids, starting at about age 5, to hate Christians and Jews in the West, funded by Saudi money. Okay? Now, when we talk about the export of terrorism, we shouldn't overlook brainwashing 5-year-olds. You know, so when we look around the world of Islam today, you know, and we see growing numbers of radicalized young Muslims, there's a reason for it. There's a lot of reasons for it, but I don't want to blame just the Saudis for it, but I'm just saying they have played a role in this. And I just want to make an observation. You know, I'm very gratified that so many of my fellow Kansans care enough about this topic that is so important to world peace to come out today. So thank you very much. And I'm going to continue to carry this message wherever I go. And I've been on the BBC and a number of international media outlets talking about some of this stuff. And I'm sharing thoughts that are provocative, but they're factual. And if anybody finds that I've made a misstatement of fact on anything, I welcome them to contact me. And we can draw our own conclusions about the facts, but everything that I said here today is factual. And so thank you all for coming out today. And Bill, I've exhausted my welcome, but thank you very much for the opportunity.
You've been listening to former Kansas Congressman Jim Slattery speaking at the University of Kansas Dole Institute of Politics on March 30th, 2015. Audio of this event was provided by Lawrence Bush of the Dole Institute. I'm Kay McIntyre. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas.